Okay, hello again. This is Dolores Cannon with the Metaphysical Hour. And I hope everybody had nice holidays because, you know, last week because of New Year's, Don shut down and just played music. So I guess we're back now with the live shows. So I hope everybody had a nice holiday season. But before we get going, I want to give out the toll-free number. The toll-free number, just in case anyone does want to call in, is 877-876-5227. 877-876-5227, and that number is good all over the world. Okay. Now, tonight I've got a special guest on here. You know, Phyllis, I haven't known you as long as some of the other ones I've had on the show, but I try to keep the guests to people that I know. It makes it a little easier on me anyway.
Oh, well, I appreciate being here.
All right. Well, our guest tonight is Phyllis Galdi, and she is the publisher and the editor of Fate magazine. And I know there's a lot of our listeners are very familiar with that magazine because I know I've been reading it for 50 years at least. So it's been around a long time. So we're going to be discussing Phyllis and what she's involved with and the magazine for the next hour here. Well, you know, Phyllis, before we get going, I always like to know about the person. Let's tell people about yourself.
Really want to know?
You know, how you got into all of this and everything.
Well, I was just a normal North Dakota Norwegian farm girl growing up on a farm with four older brothers and a very normal family. I guess I was probably the one who wasn't so normal.
Because are any of us normal?
Well, I would see a ghost in my room every night when I was a small child.
Oh.
And that scared me quite a bit, and everybody else probably thought I was hallucinating. And then finally, when I was about 25 years old, after I'd grown up and then come back home, and my mother informed me that my grandfather died in that room.
Oh. Like, I thought, you know, I said in your bio that you grew up in a haunted house.
Yes, yes. And I mean, if they would have told me that when I was young, it would have spared me a lot of anxiety and grief, because I thought that was a bad ghost and he was coming there to hurt me. I mean, I could see him. I could physically see him standing there in the doorway every night.
You didn't know it was your grandfather?
No, no, not when I was young. I just saw this male figure, so like kind of like in the movie Poltergeist, but, you
yeah.
know, just kind of a wispy white image, and it was standing in the doorway, so...
Uh-huh.
I had no idea.
Did you ever tell your parents?
Oh, yeah, all the time. I would get up, I would shut my eyes, and I would dash through the doorway there, and I would go into their bedroom and climb in bed with them because I was so scared. And
yeah.
They would even try to lock me out of their room. Of course, in these old farmhouses, you don't have locks on the doors. So they would stick a kitchen table knife up in the door to try to pry it so I couldn't get it open, and I would just be frantic.
I must have ruined their
marital life.
I'm surprised they wouldn't have said something back then about him dying in there.
Well, you know, I think she was just trying to, not encourage my imagination.
Oh, yeah, because they figured if they told you about it, might make things worse. But
Yeah, that was the old farm style. But then after I grew up, my mother started telling me that when she was first married, she would hear footsteps at night and on the stairway, and there'd be nobody home except her.
Yeah.
So she was pretty sensitive too. She just didn't. When I was growing up, she just kind of wanted to poo-poo it a little bit so I wouldn't get carried away.
Well, there wasn't any way you could move or anything, so you had to stay there.
Right. Exactly.
No matter if it's haunted or not. Well, did anything else ever happen in the house besides just seeing the ghost in the room?
After I grew up and got married and moved away and got divorced, and I came back to stay in the house. My parents lived in a mobile home in the summertime on the farm to help my brother after they had retired.
Yeah.
And so I came back to live in that old haunted house all by myself with just wood heat. That's all I had. It was very, very primitive at this point because no one had lived there for a long time. But a cat and a dog and I stayed there probably two winters.
Oh.
And it was 50 below one winter, actual temperature in North Dakota, and that's not wind chill.
Wow.
And, yes, if I wouldn't have got up to fix the stove, fix the wood fire several times a night, I probably would have frozen to death. But anyway, I would sit and play the piano in the dining room. I had an old upright piano, and I would play hymns and whatever. And I could kind of see these elderly people sitting around in the living room just listening to me.
Oh.
And it wasn't scary because my grandfather paid for a lot of immigrants to come over from Norway. He would pay, it probably cost like $40, which is not much today, but back then that was a huge amount of money in the early 1900s, 1920s, 1930s.
Yeah.
And then they would have to work off their passage on the farm, whether it was housekeeping or whatever, because my grandfather, oh, that's a good gossip story, like my grandmother left my grandfather. Nobody got divorced back in 1915.
But back in those days, you know, people didn't get divorced.
No, that was quite a scandal. But anyway, I would be scared. There was only one room I would dare sleep in at night, upstairs. I wouldn't dare leave the bedroom. Even if I had to go to the bathroom, I waited till dawn because it was like crowds of people standing outside my doorway looking at me and watching me. Just all kinds of ghosts, and I just wondered if some of them maybe were those old Scandinavian people who had worked there, like housekeepers and farm help.
You think it might have been the ones that your grandfather brought over? Then?
Probably so. I can only guess because they were totally harmless, but it was kind of scary. And then I got involved in spiritualism.
Uh-huh.
So when my daughter was in high school and my nieces and nephews, we would have seances. I learned how to do a seance at the spiritualist church. So we would do seances in the living room. We would put blankets over the window and black out everything and wait till midnight. And then we would say a prayer and all put our hands on the table and have a candle and sing Jesus Loves Me. That's about the only hymn everybody knew. And then turn out the lights. And then, oh my gosh, did we have some interesting phenomena.
I would think you would have been afraid to do that after growing up like
well,
that.
Well, you know, there's like eight or nine of us, so there's safety in numbers.
Bravery with more people there.
Exactly, and you know, we'd have a beer, a beer or something beforehand, so we had a little bottle courage, too. But we treated it pretty respectfully, and we had a lot of interesting messages, and so my grandfather came one time, and he put his hands over our hands.
Yeah.
And you could feel his, like, scratchy palm, work-worn palm, and then he came to tell us that he was moving on to another level. And we cried. We just absolutely, we weren't real knowledgeable, but it was definitely a profound experience. And then one time, one girl almost got pulled across the table. There were probably some lesser evolved entities there.
Uh-huh.
And my one nephew is a pretty good hypnotist, and he would hypnotize somebody to act as our medium so they could see and feel who was there.
Oh, okay. I didn't know if you could do that or not, but they picked up on who it was then.
Yes, yes. And we had a lot of family people come through. My grandmother came through. My grandfather came through. We heard sounds. We heard voices. We just had some really interesting phenomena that occurred. We did this for like a couple, three summers. And we figured out that doorway to that little bedroom where I slept was really a vortex to another dimension.
Well, like a portal to a dimension.
Exactly, because a lot of people who stayed in that room had strange experiences. It wasn't just me, so I think it was an actual portal.
I lived in a haunted house. My husband was in Vietnam, but that was back in the 60s. So, and I didn't have any choice. I had to stay there. I didn't have, it was in a city, though it was in St. Louis. But, you know, I didn't have any choice. I couldn't go anywhere. I had to wait there till he got back. But
mm-hmm.
It was a two-story house, and all the noises and everything were always on the upstairs part. So I know what you mean. We had a lot of very strange things that we knew were not us people in the house, you
mm-hmm.
know.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, those skeptics out there that say there isn't any such thing, you know, there is, but I never had anything, they never tried to hurt anybody.
Mm-hmm.
it's just, you know, it's scary when you hear sounds and hear doors opening and closing and people going up and down the steps when you know there's not anybody there.
Well, exactly. And being, you know, a young person, you don't expect this. You're not creating this or it's not one's imagination, because lots and lots of people heard and felt things in our house. And
you know, I always say that I had a Siamese cat. And I would sit downstairs in the living room when the kids were asleep upstairs, and that cat would sit at the bottom of the steps looking up the stairs, and he's sitting there with his tail going back and forth the way they do when they're watching something.
Mm-hmm.
And that used to give me the creeps. I said, well, you go and catch a mouse or something, you know?
Well, sure, because you know they can see things that we can't. And
oh, yeah.
They say that, yeah, cats are real sensitive to spirits.
Yeah, cats and dogs. I think cats can see them more than the dogs can.
That's what I've heard, too.
Mm-hmm. But it's a little creepy when you see it doing it. And I said, no, I'd just rather just ignore it, you know?
That's right, yep.
But then, anyway, you having a background like that, I could see why you did want to get into the metaphysical.
Well, sure, I wanted answers, I guess, and I was always interested in, like, Frankenstein and Dracula movies. So
yeah.
I wasn't the normal farm kid. I was a little bit different, but the unseen world always fascinated with me. I always wanted to know what's on the other side.
Uh-huh. I've had lots of friends on the show who are genuine psychics, and they experience stuff since childhood. But they were lucky, the ones who were still doing it, their parents didn't try to tell them it was crazy, you know, and to stop it. So they just thought it was natural, and they developed it over the years.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I think it's better to do that, but, you know, the parents are always worried about people thinking the kid's crazy or something. And
sure, there's a monster under the bed.
Oh, yeah.
And there probably is. There probably are some astral entities that small children actually can see those things.
Yeah. Uh-huh, but like you were saying, I think the only ones that I've ever heard of causing any problems are the lesser evolved entities that you're talking about,
mm-hmm.
the ones that are kind of more or less trapped in the earth plane.
Mm-hmm.
But I've never really heard of anybody being hurt by any of these anyway. You may have with the magazine.
Well, yes, we've had people who have gotten scratched and bitten and possessions. One time I was almost pulled out of the bed. That kind of really freaked me out.
Oh, no, I wouldn't like that.
No. And I mean, I was having some Kundalini experiences, and I was fasting and meditating and spending a lot of time alone. But one night it was like I was just kind of rolling out of bed that I couldn't stop myself.
Mm. Well, we see. We got as far in your life as when you were doing the seances, and of course, you never had. Well, you said you did have some strange things occur with that, but then what did you do after that? Then
I became a school teacher. I taught school for about 10-12 years.
So you were the normal one that way, anyway.
Yes, but except I always wanted to teach science fiction and fantasy and mythology and Lord of the Rings, so I always had an interest in the edges, I guess the fringe, but I was in kind of a conservative teaching environment, and of course anything ESP was equated with witchcraft, and if you were interested,
oh, yeah.
If you read the horoscope, then you were it was almost like a fundy kind of environment.
Yeah,
I had to be very careful.
I live here in Arkansas in this little bitty town. I can't even tell them what I do. You know, they think I'm strange enough because I travel. So anything like that is still viewed as the work of the devil and everything. But, you know, I keep thinking we're moving out of it, but we have these little towns that are still like that.
Yeah, some
places. I know what you're talking about, but you grew up in that kind of an environment anyway.
Yeah.
But you live up around Chicago, don't you?
No, I actually live near Minneapolis now.
Minneapolis, okay. I keep thinking of Chicago because that's where fate started out.
That's right. That's where it originated.
That's what I keep thinking of. But anyway, you were a normal, down-to-earth school teacher then for 12 years.
Yes.
Uh-huh. And how did you, how did you get the idea of getting into the magazine?
Well, it,
or were there things in between?
Well, actually, you know, I went through a divorce, and it's kind of an upheaval, but I guess it was the kind of a time for change in my life. Anyway, I was walking down the hall of the of the school where I taught in between classes, and I had my free period that time, and I heard this voice above me say, "Hand in your resignation." And I looked around. There wasn't a soul in the hallway. I was totally alone. And I heard the voice again, "Hand in your resignation." I just shrugged my shoulders. Okay. It's funny. I didn't even question it. So I walked into my classroom. It was empty because sometimes you had to share classrooms, but mine happened to be empty. Got out my typewriter, typed up the resignation. I was kind of like a robot, like I was in a trance, and went down to the superintendent's office and handed it in. And I didn't even know what I was doing or why I was doing, but I just knew I had to listen to that voice.
You didn't question it at all.
No, that's out of character for me because I'm kind of a stubborn, independent kind of person. But well, anyway, then that's when I went back up to stay in our old haunted farmhouse all by myself for a couple of years. And then one time I was down in Minneapolis with my father. We were on our way to Des Moines, Iowa to visit some family. And I was just paging through the phone book, and I opened it up to Llewellyn Publications. I said, I'm going to call them. Again, it was like I was in a trance. Something. I just called up and said, "Hey, do you have a job?" I mean, I must have sounded like an idiot. So they both send in your resume. So I wound up working for Llewellyn, and they bought Fate Magazine in, I think it was 1988. I started working there in 85.
I remember whenever they bought it. They've
right.
had it for a while.
Right.
But you know, when you're living in, you quit work, you're living out there on the farm, didn't you ever say, "What am I doing? I had a good job. You know, what's going on here?"
Oh, yeah. I was kind of frustrated, kind of kicking myself. But it was really, in one sense, it was a beautiful time by myself because I really got into metaphysics and studied a lot of spiritual things and had some quiet time. And now I look at my life and I just, it was so nice because there was like total silence. You don't have that many places in the world now.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I live out on top of a mountain in the middle of nowhere, and I love it. But you've been down here in this area. You
mm-hmm.
know what?
Yeah, it's beautiful down there.
Yeah, I love it because it's my retreat. For that reason, you know, because when you travel so much, this is where I come to get away from it all.
Sure, you can kind of rejuvenate and...
Yeah, you got to have recharge your batteries.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Because I know you've been down to when we have the UFO conference here in Eureka Springs.
Oh, I love Eureka Springs. That is just the most unique town and one of the neatest ones.
I'm just about 25 miles from there, so that's why I help every year with the UFO conference there.
Okay.
So you're very familiar with my little part of the world. Eh?
Oh, I love it down there.
So you know, I think we need that, especially when we're with people all the time and traveling so much. You got to have a way to get away. So I can understand what you mean.
Well, do you think more things happen down there, like in Eureka Springs, around that area, more psychic things? Do you think there's anything in the land?
Oh, I don't know. It's a very old place, but you don't hear a whole lot. And I know you don't hear at Huntsville because it's people don't talk about anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
Eureka Springs is different. The people who settle there are a little out of the ordinary. Well, you probably know about the haunted hotels there anyway.
Yes, yes. It's the Crescent. I've been there. That's a very interesting place.
Yeah, they've done some documentaries and special TV shows about the haunted hotels. So I guess you would say there is more there than there is in the other parts of the area. But it's a very old area, these mountains are. So, you know, a lot of things can happen, I guess.
Oh, sure. And I think sometimes the land is either, I don't know, cursed or blessed, if you will. There's some places that are real bad luck, and there's some places that are just, I don't know, more blessed, more fun to be in. And I think the indigenous people here naturally gravitated to the good places that were, you know, I think they were more intuitive and more in tune with
nature.
Yeah,
I think it senses things like that. But it could be an accumulation of energy is what I think, you know, the negative or the positive energy, that if whatever has happened there does have cause a buildup of energy.
Okay, sure.
That might be part of what you're talking about. You
mm-hmm.
know? But I do think the Indians and those people did have a feeling for places, and they would naturally go where they felt comfortable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, where it was safe, where they were either and a source of water. They'd have to have water.
Yeah. But, you know, they have done a lot of archaeological digs around here at these mountains, and they found some very, very, very old settlements. But you've been out to Sedona, haven't you?
No, I never have, not yet. Maybe next year will be a year.
Because that's a strange energy out there. And, you know, what I've heard there is, see, there were never supposed to be anyone living in the Sedona area around the Red Rocks.
Oh, really?
No, they was not supposed to, because that was the Indian sacred holy place. And they would go there and do their ceremonies. And the energy is very strong there. And they deliberately did not want anyone to live there because that's where they do their ceremonies.
Mm-hmm.
Sacred. So I think they've always resented the white man moving in and taking over. But I've only been there once, but it does have a strange energy, and other people tell me the energy is magnified when you go there.
Mm-hmm.
If you're whatever emotions you're experiencing at the time you go there, positive or negative, is magnified and blown out of proportion. So I think it is some kind of a vortex or something, because the energy is very strong.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So is the settlement, the town, is that close to the sacred areas, or is it far enough there?
It's right there. That's why it's not a good place to live.
Oh, well, many white people are very insensitive, I think. They're just kind of commercialistic, and unfortunately,
yeah. When I was there, I heard all that, and I felt something, because I was not comfortable. I just wanted to get out of there as soon as I got done with the lectures I had to do. But I kept wondering how the people live there all the time. A lot of retired people live there, and maybe the energy doesn't affect them or what, you know?
Well, I wonder if the entities, like the Native American entities, are resentful, and rightfully so, probably, with the people crowding in there.
Yeah, but I think it does have to do with the energy of the place. It was sacred, and they probably sensed that when they made it a sacred place. And so you can imagine all that energy building up over, you know, thousands of years.
Oh, sure.
But that's what I've found. It does magnify whatever emotions you have. So I think it would be a hard place to live all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So if you go there, see if you can pick up on anything.
I would love to at least go there and touch base and see the land.
It is beautiful, the big red rocks, because we had to take a bus. You know, you fly into Phoenix and take a bus to go up there, and everything looks pretty ordinary until suddenly you come over this rise on the bus, and as you're going down towards Sedona, here's all these huge, enormous red rocks. And they're not anywhere else. It's just right there.
Interesting. Do they know geologically why that happened, why it occurred?
Well, I think the people there probably know. I never really went into it with them, but it's just right there. And they're enormous, beautiful red rocks, and they change colors with the sunlight.
Interesting.
They become very intense red, or, you know, they have beautiful pictures of the different levels of the sun, how it reflects on the rocks.
Mm-hmm.
But it is just there, and then you leave it just back to normal, like it's almost semi-desert everywhere else.
Mm-hmm.
Around there.
Well, there's some beautiful, beautiful country views out there, and the tip of Arizona on Highway 80 in Utah, that there's the most incredible rock formations and landscape in Utah. A lot of Western movies used to be filmed there, but it's like you're on the moon. I mean,
yeah, that's where they used to shoot a lot of them around Sedona, too. But then now it's got too many people living there. But it was those huge red rocks that you see in the movies, you know.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
But anyway, you know, I think with both of our work, we do get into a lot of this with the energy of places and how it affects people. But you went to work for Llewellyn.
Yes. Yeah. And then shortly after that, they purchased State Magazine, and then I began working on it for a while, and then in 94, well, my mom died in 93 of a massive stroke. She had a stroke here in the house, and then she was in a coma for 9 days and died. And then my dad came to live with me for a while, and I was driving down the street, the highway near where I live, and I heard the voice again, and it said, again, you know, hand in your resume. No, it said spend this time with your dad. I didn't question the voice. Again, I turned in my resignation at Llewellyn. I quit. I didn't tell them why. I just knew I had to do it. And I had 3 good months with my dad. We had a wonderful time. We visited relatives. We traveled here and there and just did some fun things. And then he had a massive stroke. And he was lived another...
You would have missed out on that if you had to follow that.
Exactly. We just had a really, really nice father-daughter time and visited a lot of relatives and just, you know, sat around and talked and just kind of hung out and did what we wanted to do. So, yes, I was so grateful that I had that time with him.
Well, when you were working with Llewellyn, were you the editor there or what?
At first, I was the senior editor for books, but then after they bought the magazine, then I was the managing editor of Fate magazine for several years, and in the last year, I was the editor in chief until I quit.
You were quite familiar with Fate magazine, then.
Yes, yes. I mean, it was just so easy. It was like falling into an old shoe because all the subject matter was so natural and so normal to me.
Yeah.
And then I ran my own publishing company. And then in 99, the folks at Llewellyn called David Godwin and I back because they were thinking about either selling it or pulling the plug and just killing the magazine. And so we came in and ran it. And then I said they were, you know, going to sell it. So I said, sell it to me. So the bank and I now own it.
So I'm thinking the bank, because that's a big project to take on.
Yes, yes, it is a labor of love, but...
Did Llewellyn think it was too much to do both?
Well, they weren't making any money on it, and really they were a big enough business that was their primary incentive or directive to, you know, because they had like 100 employees and they wanted to be profitable, and there were a lot of fingers in the pie with Llewellyn, so it took a lot of money to keep it going. There were quite a few payrolls for different people, but now we do all the pre-press out of my home, and I have part-time workers that come and help, and we do all the pre-press here, and now with desktop publishing, it's so much simpler and easier.
Well, sir, are you still living in the haunted house there?
Well, no, I live in... I guess this house is about 20 years old. It's a rambler, but it definitely has its entities here, too, that several people
you
have.
You don't live out in the country of that far like you used to.
No, no, it's just a suburb of Minneapolis, there's wetlands bordering on the north side, and there's just some strange things that happen here, too. For a long time, nobody would go downstairs after dark. There's kind of a vortex downstairs in the... It's now an office area, but it was kind of like a mother-in-law's room for a while. And several people who have stayed here have felt things in that room and have seen people. In fact, that room was where my mother had her stroke.
Oh.
And she collapsed in that room while writing out Christmas cards. And she died on a full moon. A month later, on the full moon, I was in the next room right next to there, and I saw her spirit, her, you know, entity. She came walking out of there.
Mm.
So yeah, the full moon always bothered her when she was in the physical body. So it was interesting, yeah, that she died on a full moon, and 28 days later, then she manifested, came back on the full moon. But I was still grieving, and I was just crying. I couldn't deal with it then. She has since appeared to me in my bedroom, and one night I woke up, and here was my mother's spirit and my grandmother and my aunt, and my mother said, I just brought Ma and Sis to show them your house. I said, okay, and just rolled over and went back to sleep, and, you know, Ma was the grandmother, and then Sis was my aunt. And it was just like, no big deal, just okay, you know, kind of shrugged my shoulders, all right.
All right, I was thinking she may have come back on the full month later, just to try to make you feel better.
Oh, sure, I know it. But I was, you know, in my own selfish grief. I should have been okay with it, but it was too soon. But it's interesting, when my dad died, he died in Mom died in 93 and Dad died in 95.
Uh-huh.
And 3 days after my dad died, he woke up real fast in the spirit world. I was mixing this Christmas drink. It's hot Tom and Jerry. It's got a little brandy and rum and this thick egg mixture in there. And it's very rich and very good, but they're only fun when it's real cold out. And my dad liked a little glass of brandy at night. But anyway, I heard this voice behind me. He says, "Gee, Dolly, that looks good." And Dolly was my dad's nickname for me.
Yeah, he's probably wishing he could taste it. Yeah.
Well, exactly, yeah. I mean, but, you know, and I wasn't nervous or afraid at all then. It was just totally normal, totally, he was there looking over my shoulder. And, yep, you're right, wishing he could have a taste of that.
Uh-huh. Well, let's go into the history of Fate Magazine. I know it's been a long, around over 50 years, because when I got my first copies, it was in the 1950s.
Yes, well, actually, Fate started in 1948. That's the very first issue.
I probably got my first one just a few years after it started then.
Right. We just did a reprint, an exact replica of the very first issue, spring 1948, and the cover story was about Kenneth Arnold's UFO sighting out in Mount Rainier.
Ah.
And he was a professional pilot, and I mean, it was just, and he took photographs. I mean, he had the wherewithal in the little airplane he was in, the little Cessna, to actually take photographs of the flying discs, and that was almost kind of the birth of the flying saucer era, and not that
that was in the 40s is when all that first began anyway, right.
Right
after the war, so that would have been right at that time, wouldn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. But that was the first issue, and I know you, when I talked to you before, you said that there was some water damage or something, where they had all the old magazines, so a lot of the old archives were lost.
Exactly. There were very few when we took over the magazine of the old magazines, because some of them got wet and were ruined and destroyed. And you know, they even kept the old edit files, but some of those got wet and destroyed. It was very, very unfortunate.
That's why I gave you all my collection this last year.
Yes, we appreciate that so much.
I thought maybe you had a lot of those, but there may have been some copies in there that were missing from yours, you know.
Oh, no, we didn't. There's a bound set, but you can't photocopy them. Sometimes they cut off the edges, so they're really not as easy to look at as the individual magazines.
Uh-huh.
They're much more user-friendly.
Well, you know, the first ones I got were back in the early 50s. Because it was right, I got married in 51, so, but I remember I'd always been fascinated by the unusual and strange, and I never, you know, I just thought it was interesting. And I remember seeing the first Fate magazine, and I thought, well, wow, here's a magazine that's all about the things I'm interested in. And that was the first one I got, and I think it did have a lot about UFOs in it.
It kind of started out that way, that it was UFO heavy,
uh-huh.
And then they started telling about some sensational stories and about Richard Shaver, the strange guy who had he believed he was communicating with people from under the earth, the Deros and the Neros.
Uh-huh. Well, I remember I was reading it for that reason about the UFOs, and then I started looking at the other stories, and I said, well, wow, it's not just that. It's all the kind of thing I was interested in. And that first few years, I didn't get every copy because I just discovered it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why when I gave you, from the 60s on, I think I had just about every month issue, but it was the 50s. I only had about five or six. So,
weren't the covers wonderful in the 50s?
Oh, yeah, but, you know, mine were packed away where, oh, the mice and those little weevils get into it.
Right, right, yep. We sure appreciate having them, right? And in the 60s, they just had type on the cover. They didn't have the pretty paintings and drawings. And
that's all they had.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I told you, I didn't know what to do with them, and you said you didn't care if they smelled musty and
looked bad. No, they're all aired out and just fine now.
Okay. But, anyway, they started way back there with Curtis Fuller. Was he the first owner?
Ray Palmer. One of the, you know, originators.
Ray Palmer was the first, wasn't he?
Yes, yes. And then he and Curtis Fuller got together, and then after a few years, then Curtis and Mary Fuller took it over all themselves. And they ran it for 30 years.
I was thinking he was the only one that I ever knew about that were doing it. This must be one of the oldest magazines still in print in the United States.
It is the longest-running paranormal magazine in the world.
Oh, okay.
It's interesting, when the Fullers sold Fate magazine to Llewellyn in, I think it was 87 or 88, and then they died not too many years after that, both of them. They worked hard. Sometimes retirement, I don't think, is a good thing, because people just kind of lose their joie de vivre. They lose their interest in life. But anyway, there's Kurt and Mary Fuller. Spirits would come around and not haunt us, but visit us at the magazine. And they were actually here in my house. I didn't sense them, but our person who does our website did, and he said it just scared the heck out of him. He was downstairs sitting at a desk, and all of a sudden, poof, they were there. he's a good Catholic boy. He was just kind of scared him a little bit, but he definitely knew it was them.
But I know, you know, I agree with you. I think if somebody, that is their whole life, that's their baby, and then suddenly they don't have it anymore, even though they think retirement's going to be great, something has gone out of their life.
Well, exactly. The raison d'etre, I mean, it's your reason for living. It's like the impetus to get up and do, unless you have some other passion, if it's gardening or photography or writing. I mean, I think you have to have something that really makes you want to get out of bed in the morning and be excited. And
yeah.
Right, they no longer had faith, and they lived, breathed it. I mean, they were so devoted and dedicated. And
then all of a sudden, it's not there anymore.
Right. So you just kind of wind down.
You hear that from a lot of people that are business people, and as soon as they retire, they die because they've lost their incentive. Their baby, really, handed it over to somebody else, you know.
Yeah, so unless you do a second career or something that keeps your interest. Why, I don't think retirement is all what it's cracked up to be.
No, they say a lot of people don't live very long after they really retire.
Nope.
Yeah, one man said, "Oh, I'll be fine. Just park me by a lake and I'll fish all the time." Well, that'll get old pretty soon.
Oh, sure. It might be fun for a couple of weeks, but then after that, it's especially if you've been active your life. Maybe in older generations, when our world was much simpler, but now we have so much stimulation.
But it's the same way, you know. Like both of us, you got to keep your mind active, and I think that's where you grow old, is when you stop using your mind.
I agree. Yep.
Yeah, you know, because I'm a publisher, too, so I know we're both going through all of this.
Yeah, some days you want to tear your hair out and wonder why you're doing it, but it's just, I think it's in your blood.
Yeah, because I know you always think, am I going to have enough money now to put this next book out and all of that, you know?
Yeah, there is that challenge always.
You know, we keep thinking, well, I've got all these projects I want to do. Where's the money going to come from? So you have a lot of things to worry about.
Oh, yeah, there is definitely stress.
But I think still I wouldn't give it up, and I don't think you would either.
Oh, no. It's just, it's really, really fun. I really like it, even though I, you know, sometimes...
It's a headache because people don't realize all the ins and outs of putting some... I know what it's like to print books, but you're doing the magazine every month, and you're also doing your publishing company.
Yep, I know. I'm a glutton for punishment.
So, I mean, I know what you're going through because I do the same thing, but I don't have to put out a monthly magazine on top of it all. But, you know, the one thing I didn't like about Llewellyn was they changed the format of Fate magazine. You know, they went to the bigger size magazine.
Yes.
You know what I mean? It was
The 8.5 by 11, the size of like Time and Newsweek, and it was meant to be like Reader's Digest size. So yeah, it's much more fun when it's the small size. It just has a different personality, a different energy, a different character.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a lot of people said they didn't like it when they made that change.
No, and you know, that's when I quit, too. That was probably another reason, because I protested, but it was all in vain. Just couldn't do anything about it.
I remember, wasn't it a few years ago, there was even a debate about changing the name of Fate magazine?
Mm-hmm.
They wanted to change it to something else, I think. Do you remember that?
Yep, I do. I know Carl talked about that more than once.
And I don't remember what they wanted to call it, but I think people had just gotten so used to it being Fate that I don't think they would recognize it by any other name.
No, definitely that was a mistake.
Uh-huh. But I do think it was a mistake going to the bigger size.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, then you said it wasn't too many years that they sold it then. And then when you got it, you took it back to the original size.
Right. Well, first I kind of leased the magazine, so I really didn't have the authority to do much except continue on in the same vein. But then I talked to them, and they said it was fine. So we actually changed the size before we bought it.
Uh-huh. But, yeah, I think that I liked it when it went back to the original, because I had been getting it for so many years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, overwhelmingly, we've gotten a good response from folks that they just like the personality. It's just more friendly.
Yeah. But you get used to something. Then everybody says, yeah, but, you know, time marches on. You got to change.
That's
but
right.
Some things you don't really want to change.
No, no. The retro look is part of its attraction, part of its appeal.
Uh-huh. Well, can you think of any stories you want to tell that has happened since you got the magazine?
Well, I guess one thing I might point out is there's over, like, 60,000 stories in Fate magazine over the years. And the one or the two types of stories that people seem to like the best are the My Proof of Survival and True Mystic Experiences, which people write in about their own haunted experience or being saved by an angelic kind of person or just a good Samaritan who probably was an angel.
I used to turn to that part every time I would get the magazine. And you know, I've written for Fate magazine, but it was many, many years ago.
Oh, interesting.
But I always turn to that part, too, about the true experiences where people send in.
It's kind of like a Bible for a lot of people because it's... I'm gonna switch phones here. Just a minute, please.
You go to what?
Okay, you still there?
But you changed phones or what?
Yep, I did change phones because that one was... I don't know, a little bit sickly or crackling, whatever. I didn't want it to...
Was it a cell phone?
No. It's a cordless phone.
But it was beginning to act up?
Yep, I didn't want it to. But anyway, those stories are the absolute all-time favorite of people. And as I was saying, that it's kind of like a Bible to them in a way because it gives them spiritual hope that their life goes on.
Yeah.
There's more to it than this world, and sometimes this world isn't real kind to some people. But I think it's just wonderful to know that when we depart this mortal coil, that isn't the end of it. We just step out of our body and keep on.
Mm-hmm. Keep well, on you know, going. I've been involved in this now for 40 years in my work, and they're still very simple stories. I've moved beyond that, but I think that's what a lot of people need, especially when they're just starting out in this. They need the simple ones, the ones that they can relate to.
Exactly. It's a very good start. It's a real good introduction. A lot of high school libraries carry Fate now.
Oh.
And we try to keep it very, very wholesome, too, but it's kind of neat to see that because kids like stories about ghosts and monsters and UFOs.
UFOs and all that. But, you know, for a long time, all of this was kind of taboo.
Exactly. It was not acceptable. It was kind of, I don't know, not forbidden, but it was frowned upon.
I think that is interesting that they're carrying it now in their libraries. Yeah, that's good.
Yes. I mean, I'm thrilled every time. And having been a junior and senior high school English teacher myself, I try to keep the stories so they're wholesome and they're provocative and make people think, and there's some factual basis. Another thing I think that the reason why Faith has survived, because all the stories are real experiences. They've happened to people. They've seen this. They had this happen to them, rather than some expert telling you this is how it is, this is the way it is.
Yeah. Of course, I know there have always been skeptics that say, well, this didn't really happen, but I think over the years that I've been reading it, I believe just about most of the ones that are printed in there. And I like it whenever the writer does research, because that's what I do. I research when I'm writing my books. I research it to death because I want to know everything about it. So I like it when the writers in the magazine have done their research, gone to these places, you know, and taken the pictures. And
well, exactly. I've been there, done that. I saw this, and then I had this experience when I traveled to this place rather than
just, you know, writing about something somebody else has done.
Yep. Secondhand
information.
Yep. Well, you are remarkable, Dolores. All your incredible amount of information and the books that you publish are just unbelievable. I don't know how you do it all.
Oh, I think I'm like you. We just go 24/7.
Maybe that's part of being that Aries blood.
You're Aries too, aren't you?
Yeah, that's right. I think we have the very same birthday, April 15th, if I recall.
Yeah, I think the last time I met you, you did say that.
Right.
April 15th. That's what I always say. The Aries are the ones that go in with the angel spirit of tread.
That's right.
We do things that other people just won't take a chance on.
It's more fun, though. I like living on the edge, walking on the edge, thinking about the edge.
I've got a friend, I think she's a Capricorn or a Sagittarius, and she says, yeah, you go around the world twice while I'm sitting there thinking about it.
Nah, that's a great way to put it. Yeah, well, you do. I mean, you have been...
That we don't stop to question it. We just do it, you know,
yes.
Worry about it later, think, what did I get into?
Well, I just think life is just a lot more exciting. I have to ask
you.
Yeah,
it's a lot more interesting this way. But are you still doing the editing for the magazine also?
Oh, yes. I read every issue, every article.
So you're still doing all of that?
No, there's two of us that read everything, and then David Godman, he actually puts the magazine together, puts the illustration in, and makes everything fit. And Andy and I.
So you're very hands-on with the whole
definitely
thing.
Well, because we have such a small staff, we have to be. But it's fun, too. I mean, if I had somebody else do it, then it wouldn't be our magazine anymore. It would just be something impersonal.
That's it. I've got people working for me now, but I'm the one that makes the decisions which books are published, and I like to do the editing and then let them take it from there, you know, to produce it into a book. But I enjoy that hands-on.
Oh, yes. That's part of the excitement.
Yeah, otherwise if somebody took that away, you know, making the decisions. I just love English. I love the language, so I like to edit. So I wouldn't enjoy it if somebody took all that away from me.
Oh, I have to ask you, with your metaphysical, spiritual background and, of course, dealing with life and death, stories and fate. I mean, the proof of survival that life goes on, I think, is one of the main things. And I turned 60 last year, and I thought, oh my gosh, I'm going to die one day. And all of a sudden, like, I'm not going to live forever. Because when you're young, I think you're immortal. You just don't even think about it. But and David Godman, our managing editor, had a very serious heart attack this summer, and it really made me examine things more closely. And sometimes I think, I'm afraid to die. I don't want to die. It's like I feel I'm going to be snuffed out, like I'm going to be suffocated.
No, it's not like that at all.
No, I've seen so many ghosts and dead people have manifested to me, so I know that. But of course, none of us will know until we are there.
But in the work I've done, you know, I wrote the book Between Death and Life, and it's translated all over the world. In there, you know, it's what I found through the hypnosis, you know, whenever they've gone through the death experience from other lives. And they said dying is so simple, it's so easy, it's just sliding out of your body. Just like getting up from one chair and sitting down in another chair. It's very easy, very simple. So the fear of death, really, it doesn't need to be there because it's not really it's not that frightening. Besides, you know, we go out of our body every night.
When we dream. I know I've had some conscious
astral
projection.
Well, it would be just like that. It would just be sliding out of the body and just saying, I don't want to go back, you know.
But then, in your experiences, of course, when I see my relatives that manifest the ghostly things, they just stop by to say hello. And what do they do the rest of the time? I know time is different in the spirit world.
Well, they are doing it. They're having a ball. There's so much to do over there. There's so many places to go and things to learn. There's wonderful schools and universities, and they can just do anything they want. It's an extremely beautiful place. It's in my book, Between Death and Life.
I'll have to take a look at that again. I'll have to take a closer look.
Okay, because I go into all the places you can go and what it's like, and it's not anything to be afraid of. They really are very busy.
Mm-hmm.
But let me ask you about your publishing company. Talk about that.
Oh, Galdi Press. We have about 100 books in print, and the majority of them are metaphysical. We have half a dozen UFO books. We have books about ghosts, and we have one by a hypnotherapist who hypnotizes people. In fact, she is good. I would love to be hypnotized by you too, by the way.
Well,
we have some children's books, and
we're together sometime.
Okay, that sounds good. We have half a dozen military books, like World War I, World War II kinds of books.
Oh, okay. But one I've noticed, most of yours seem to be small books. They're not very, very thick, not very many pages. Is that correct?
Well, most of them are kind of 6x9 size, 250, you know, under 300 pages. We do have one called UFOs.
The ones I saw at the BEA, I thought they were about maybe 100 pages. But
no, maybe that's just the new books that I had there at the time. But most of our books are 6x9, 250, 300 pages.
Okay,
we have one, UFOs, The Century of Signing, which is 8.5x11, a large book, and that's 300 and some pages.
Okay, that's about the size. I usually run about 250 to 300 pages in the books we publish. So, what if somebody wants to submit something to you?
Well, we survive on submissions. Most of our stories are written by people, just ordinary people, and we pay for 10 cents a word and $10 per illustration. So we pay for all the articles that we publish in the magazine, and they can call us on our 800 number, or they can email us or check out our website. There's lots of different ways.
Go ahead and give out those numbers and the website.
Sure. Our website is where you can just type in Fate, F-A-T-E, magazine on Google, and it will take you to our website. But our website is fatemag.com, FATEMAG.com. And we have a toll-free number, 1-800-728-2730. 800-728-2730. 2730.
And if they check out the website, it'll give instructions on how to submit to you.
Yes, yes. And the best thing
what about the publishing company? Can they also submit manuscripts?
Oh, sure. We're certainly open. We're a little bit busy because we're a small staff, but we'd love to take a look at books, people's personal experiences, metaphysical books. And that website is galdipress.com. That's GALDEPRESS.com.
And then they can find all of the requirements and everything.
Sure. And we have a toll-free number for Galdi Press, too, for our books. It's 1-800-777-3454. 1-800-777-3454.
Okay, because, you know, that way they can get a hold of you. And the magazine is available everywhere.
Yes, pretty much in many, many bookstores. Of course, the least expensive way is to subscribe. And you can subscribe online on our website or by calling our 800 number. And it's $19.95 for 6 months. It's a monthly magazine. It's published every month, 12 issues a year. It's $32.95 for a year, and then $57.95 for 2 years. So it's very inexpensive reading for every month, just pennies a day, and it makes a great gift, the gift that keeps on giving, because we have a lot of people who use it for Christmas, birthday presents, because it's an easy gift, and then you sure get your money's worth.
And I can vouch for the high quality of the magazine. All these years, it has not, gone into, like a lot of them have done. They go downhill. It has always maintained a high quality of stories and the publication itself.
Thank you. I appreciate that. It's kind of like Faith is its own entity, I'll have to say.
Uh-huh.
It kind of runs itself, and we are the stewards of it. And it's interesting that the stories come in, the articles, like all of a sudden we're like, hit across the head, like, hello, you got to write about crop circles, or hello, you got to write about vampires. Or,
uh-huh.
I mean, it just kind of tells us what we're supposed to write itself.
Well, see, that's what I always feel, that my books took on a life of their own, and they become their own entity. And
sure, they have their own personality.
Thing. That's what you mean.
Mm-hmm.
See,
yes.
We're going to have to sign off because we're getting to the time, or Don's going to pull the plug. But I did want to break up a remark. Aren't you now running some kind of a thing that's online for research?
Well, we have a Fate online research. That's on our website, yes.
You have all of the old stories now have been put into a database, haven't they?
No, not all of them. But, I mean, we can certainly do photocopies of issues or articles. So we do have an index of all the articles, and we have most of the old issues in a bound volume. So we're able to photocopy them if people call up and want. We charge a real modest fee for research, but if there's some specific topic you want to know about, the Black Virgin Mary of Kazan or something, we have it in our index, and we can.
Because I know when I gave you all of my back issues, I said I wanted to copy a lot of them, but I didn't have time. You said, don't worry, we'll be able to get it through your online service.
Yes, well, yeah, any research that you have, then we can photocopy it for whatever you want.
Okay, well, we're going to have to go off. And everybody knows my website is Ozark Mountain. It's OZARKMT.com. If you want to check in there, find out about everything that we're doing. But Phyllis, I want to really thank you for being on. I think it's been a good show, and you've really enlightened a lot of people.
Well, it was an honor to be on your show. Thank you for having me, Dolores.
And I know I want to see you again one of these days.
Oh, yes. Well, I'll probably see you in April.
Yeah, we keep running into each other.
That's right.
Okay. Well, good night, everybody.